You should vote for Ananya and Donovan.
For which position?
For which position? Members of Parliament.
This was a conversation that I peeked into a few minutes before a government and economics class.
Today's going to be busy, so I think they're just going to send out the ballot. But I'm like, you guys should definitely vote for them. I trust them. I trust them to know what they're doing. And I mean, if I'm saying that, like, you guys know how involved I was in making the Constitution, so.
We know.
Yeah, we know.
I'm just, we need to get through this election first before we figure anything else out.
I will say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Ethan has been very, very transparent with his plans for corruption.
Yeah, but we can't have the judge elections today because we need to make the rubric before the judge comes into power.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Tom, are you making a podcast?
I'm making a podcast.
You're listening to the Tom Gibson Podcast, and in today's episode, we are going into Mike Franz's government and economics class where students are playing what I think is the most complex game of life called YOLO. I sit down with Mike and we talk about some of the details of the game, what this game looks like from beginning to end, what the objectives of the game are, how he uses the game in his assessments in class, what he does when he sees corruption in the game, as well as ways that teachers can bring in and incorporate gamification in their classrooms.
My name is Mike Franz. This is my seventh year as a full-time teacher. Right now, I teach government and economics, and in the past, I've also taught psychology and public speaking. YOLO stands for You Only Live Once, because it is a game that simulates life, and you only get to play the game once. YOLO is a government and economics-based game that I created that we play all throughout the year. We play it one day a week, and in the game, each week is meant to simulate 1 year of real life. So when the kids start the year, it's like they're 18 years old and they just graduated high school and mom and dad are kicking them out with no help. And they have to decide what they're going to do. Are they going to go to college? What kind of career path are they going to take? And there's 32 weeks in the school year. So the game lasts 32 rounds or 32 weeks or 32 years. So it's kind of like when they finish the game, it's like they're in their early 50s. Hopefully they've saved for retirement. And that's kind of the basis of the game. There's a lot of different careers they can choose in the game. There's a lot of different routes they can choose in the game. And there's certain things that they all have to have. Like they all have to have things like food and housing and transportation. And really what it does is it sets up kind of a mini economy within the classroom and different roles in the game produce different things that are then sold on a free market or maybe a government-controlled market to the rest of the class. And the class also can form their own government, and that government can be very hands-on or not. And they can pass legislation to kind of add rules to the game and legislate the class however they want or tax the class however they want. So that's the most basic rundown I can give. But as you saw, the game gets pretty complex pretty quickly.
Yeah, I am commissioned by the government to create the YOLO board. So every day I have to keep up with the land that's bought, the houses that are built, the irrigation that's put in.
Can you describe the board that's in front of us?
Yeah, we have a circle of plots, the outside plots. I believe there are 20. And then the plots get wider as we go to the center, and then we have a really lush center plot that we can build later in the game. And then there are four corner plots around the board.
So this is just a representation of the world you guys are living in.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. And everyone who has a house has a house on the board, and irrigation that's built, you can see it. And then if land is polluted, then the land is brown because it can't be habited.
like Settlers of Catan?
Exactly.
How do you roll this out to the students? How do you introduce it to them in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming to them?
Yeah. So we started right at the beginning of the year. You know, I kind of do my first day of school is like go through the syllabus kind of thing. And then the next thing we do is we dive right into YOLO. So there is a little bit of work on the front end of the school year. And it does take some time at the beginning of the school year. You know, usually it's like a solid 2 days of just going through this instruction booklet. But what's cool is as I'm going through the instruction booklet, we're already going off on tangents about things. You know, like we talk, one of the kind of mechanics in the game is there's energy, which is kind of like oil or coal. You know, it's kind of a blend of the two. And it gives us a good excuse to talk about oil and coal in the real world and the economics of those and just kind of how they work and what they do to land. And there's tangents galore even as we go through the rule book. In the first 12 or so weeks, kids are having to figure out who's going to be the farmer and who's going to grow food. They're selling food to the rest of the class. Kids have to move into their own house by the end of the 12th week. So there's other kids that build the houses. So kids kind of have to figure out who's going to build, where you're going to get your house. So there's a lot of stuff like that at the beginning of the game. I allow them to write their own constitution starting in week 4. The only reason I don't really do it earlier is because there's so much action in the first few weeks anyway. The class you came and saw the other day, they were in their 10th week, and they actually did not ratify their constitution until the end of the 9th week. So they basically fought over that thing for like a good 6 weeks before they ratified it. So you actually saw the first class in which they had their own laws. They'd finally started raising taxes, things like that.
So taxes and how much the constitution,
I get paid an extra stipend because I'm the sanitation commissioner, and that's raised through taxes. And since this is the first week, the government doesn't have any money, so we have to do it kind of in a roundabout way so that I can actually get my money.
What do you mean the government doesn't have any money?
Because this is the first week that there has been tax collection, because this is the first week that that there has been a government. There's a bunch of like penalizations for not doing things. Like, they took this out, but there used to be a penalization if you didn't have health insurance. You were fined $1 million, which is kind of crazy. But,
And then as the game goes on, it's not like a role-playing game. It's not like a Model UN type game where I'll introduce things in the middle of the game like, hey, there's been an earthquake. That doesn't happen. There are potentially disasters in the game, but you could, in theory, kind of foresee everything beforehand, even though, you know, there's dice and things like that that kind of keep kids on their toes.
What is the role of the dice? How does that all work?
The rain roll determines how many crops grow for the farmers, which determines how much food we have for the class. And then the stock roll determines what percentage the stock, or like whoever has stocks or money in stocks, what percentage it goes up.
Okay.
16%.
Yeah!
What is happening?
Why is this shit happening?
But as the game goes on and progresses, kids have to start dealing with things like healthcare crises, right? Like if kids aren't eating properly, they have what's called a health rating. And as that health rating drops, they have the potential to get sick and face a big medical bill. And if they can't pay that medical bill, the rest of the class has to. So if you followed all of that, it creates little booby traps throughout the year that if the class isn't diligent in kind of minding these traps, it will hurt students and potentially the whole class. What the class hasn't discovered yet this year is that energy is going to start running out, and probably somewhere around week 15, 20, 25, they're going to not have enough energy, and they're going to have to figure out another solution. That could be inventing a solar-powered car. That could be building a dam to produce energy. But the kids are going to either have to solve this problem collectively or basically face the consequences. But they haven't really started to feel the pain of that yet. So as the year progresses, there's kind of these little things that pop up slowly but surely that kind of challenge them in different ways.
So how do you kind of is like, well, what's your role actually in all of it?
Yeah, so I've got kind of a funny role. So, you know, I created the game. But once it gets up and running, we go by the rule book, you know, so I won't change rules in the middle of the year. There's even been years where I made like a little mistake. It's like, well, I won't change the rule book. We treat the rule book as if it is a federal constitution. And even I, as the creator of the game, don't have the power to change that. Once the game gets up and running, I do still have a few rules or roles. I am the Supreme Court Justice. So each class has a judge. Actually, the class you saw in their constitution, they basically kind of minimize the powers of the judge, and any disputes with the rules or between players, they handle with a trial by jury where they randomly select 5 jury members and then a three-person vote would, you know, decide what happens. But if I feel like a case is decided in a way that violates the rule book, I will overturn that case. So as the Supreme Court Justice, I can do that. I also have the power to strike down any ridiculous laws they make. So if they pass a law that says we're going to go to the park every day and Mike Franz is going to buy us pizza, I strike that down. Really, I've actually never struck a law down. They have, if they pass a law that's corrupt or law that I don't think is good, I let that happen. I just kind of keep that rule in the back pocket for ridiculous examples. Another role I have is a small one, but I am the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So there's an interest rate at which kids can borrow money, and I adjust the interest rate. And it is a very tiny role. But other than that, I mean, really, I have a very small role. I'm there to kind of just facilitate the game and keep it running. Even leave this game with subs. When I have a sub, once the game's up and running, you know, I couldn't bring in a sub in the first few weeks. But once we're in like week 15, you know, if I have to take a day off, I make it a YOLO day because the game really just runs itself. The sub just kind of sits in the corner and watches the madness ensue.
There seems to be a lot that needs to stay organized. How do you approach that?
Yeah, good question. So like I said, every kid in the game has a job. And some of those jobs are basically helping me run the game. So we've got a loan officer. So when kids want to borrow money from the federal YOLO government, I'll call it, they go to the loan officer. The loan officer has a spreadsheet that I've created, and they know how to kind of enter a car loan versus a home loan versus a credit card loan. So they keep track of that. There's what we call the Food and Agriculture Commissioner, right? So when a farmer grows food, well, where does the actual food come from? Well, I've got little pieces of paper with like meat or carbohydrates, you know, like wheat or whatever, vegetables. You know, I've got little pieces of paper that I made with these pictures of food. They go to the Food and Ag Commissioner, and that person actually gives the farmers the food. And then when a kid later eats the food, they take it back to the Food and Agriculture Commissioner, and those people just enter it into a spreadsheet. So there's basically little roles that help run the game. Now, in the first year, I didn't think of having kids do it, and I was just doing everything. So I was like swamped on YOLO days, you know, and then I kind of had TAs my second year, and the TAs were doing it. But I remember one year, I don't know how the school let me do this, but I had like three TAs in one class, you know, and they're just so busy with YOLO. And it finally occurred to me, I could just pay kids to do this, and then it's part of the game. So it works out really well. It's a little bit of a well-oiled machine now, even though I think if you walked in on my class and you saw it, you'd think it's just absolute craziness because kids are standing up, walking around the room, sometimes yelling at each other, like, why are you trying to pass this legislation? This is terrible. Or like, who's got food? I need two pieces of protein. Who's got protein? I'll pay anything for two proteins. But I kind of like it like that. I think that that's where there's a lot of excitement behind the game. And I think that that's the enthusiasm is the best part about it.
Tell me what your role is.
I'm a doctor. Well, I mean, I have to try to buy food. And I don't have a house or a car yet, so I'm hopefully going to get those today. I made a contract with Henry, who makes houses. I'll either get one this week or next week, I don't know yet, and then have a contract with Ethan for him to make me a car this week.
I'm a laborer. What a laborer does is, in order for a contractor or a car manufacturer to build either a car or a house, they have to have a laborer, so I get like a labor cost for the house.
Yeah, so I make sure that people pay rent. That's been my main job a lot. I also am in charge of putting people's monies into stocks or bonds, depending on what they want. So there's three different kinds of bonds that I can put money into, and then the stock roll, which changes every week.
What's the difference between a stock and a bond?
So the bonds go up at a fixed percentage, whereas the stocks are a bit more variable, but there's more chance to get a higher increase. We have 2% bonds, 3% bonds, and 3.5% bonds. But this week, the stock roll was 16% increase, which is high, but there's also a chance for it to go down.
Where are most people putting their money?
It really depends. A lot of people are doing a mixture between stocks and bonds, but the 2% bond is very common because it makes you money, but you can withdraw it the next week instead of having to leave it in. It's chaotic, but it's fun. I mean,
and you said if kids kind of pass laws that really aren't great laws, but they're not the ridiculous ones you talked about, you let them go. I also heard, I was asking students about different people that were running for office, and some people felt that there were some students that were looking to sabotage the game just to make it interesting. Like, yeah. When that happens, what does that end up looking like, and what are like the teaching points that you use in those situations?
Yeah. The best thing about teaching this class is the things that I see happen in the game and what I learn from them. And I believe it was my second year running the game, And kids were running for office, so they're having their election day. And each kid's kind of standing up and giving their really generic speech of why you should vote for them. And, you know, it's all just like, yeah, I'm going to just do my best for the class. I'm really here to serve the people. And it's very, you know, like low level political sounding. And then this one kid stands up and he just says, if you vote for me, I'll give you $10,000. And everybody kind of looked around the room stunned. And everybody kind of looks at me like, can he do that? And he goes, seriously, even if I don't win, I'll give you $10,000. I've got $240,000 cash right here. I can do it. And my first instinct was like, oh my gosh, how did I let this happen? Like, there's nothing in the rules that says this is illegal. Like, I can't stop this. But it pretty quickly occurred to me, like, this is real life. Like, this happens all over the world. This has happened all throughout history. And this is one of the challenges of a government, is to figure out a way to prevent this from happening. And over the years, I've seen a number of, I would say every class has a touch of corruption. You know, the way I look at it is, the analogy I like to use is that it's like weeds in the garden. You know, that you've got this beautiful flower, which is democracy or liberty, but it's inevitable that weeds will come. No matter what you do to get rid of the weeds, they will always pop up, and corruption will always pop up. But some classes go much further than others. I mean, I've classes that were basically overthrown by small groups of kids. Usually this has happened at the end of the year. But one year I had really four kids kind of sneak in a piece of legislation, you know, like into a constitutional amendment that nobody read. And it really just said like, hey, we're changing the way we amend the Constitution. So now the four of us can amend the Constitution. And once that had passed, they really had complete control. And there was nothing I could really do about it. Nothing I really wanted to do about it, because this happens. You know, this is, I suspect, what happens in a lot of corrupt governments throughout the world, throughout history, is there's an overthrow and it's actually kind of legal. You know, like they amend the Constitution that basically just says that guy's in charge now and he can do whatever he wants. And, you know, when that happens in class, it's a bit of a free-for-all for the rest of the year. I've never had it happen early in the year, but I've seen it happen maybe 2-3 times where a class towards the end of the year gets completely overhauled by a small group.
What's your platform, or like, why would people in this YOLO group want to vote for you, and why would they vote against you?
Well, I think the reason they vote for me is because I'm one of the most knowledgeable people about the rule book, the current constitution that just got ratified, and the general workings of YOLO. And I think a reason that they wouldn't vote for me is because people don't really trust that I will have like a good intention if I get into office with like Sam, because there could be a lot of collusion there and trying to make the class kind of fall into anarchy. Because at one point I was very anti Sam's constitution, which is the current one that's ratified. So with that position of power, I could really request to be amended, which is something I might actually do, so that the constitution could go back to a state where, because right now the constitution is 6 pages long and only like 4 people have fully read the constitution. And all of them are running for public office, I think, because we've all read the Constitution. So if we all get in power, it could leave behind some of the general populace instead, and more focus on benefiting us, which I'm going to try not to do that, but we'll see.
Well, in my opinion, there are a lot of people in this class who want to grab power without knowing what power they're grabbing. The people that I was throwing my support behind, Ananya and Donovan, I trust them to know the Constitution backwards and forwards and to be fair and not corrupt. That benefits everyone in the class, not just me.
Students were going to be voting today, but they had to figure out what to do in the situation that someone was not there to vote, but their Constitution says that everyone must vote.
Or voting is mandatory.
Okay. But what if they're not here?
Exactly.
If so they're not here, it doesn't sound like they're... I'm pretty sure Mike says in the federal constitution, if they're not here, it's like they're not here for the week.
So essentially, yeah. We're voting on whether or not to take away her right to vote.
For this week.
Well,
this,
okay. But the thing is, like, the precedent is, especially for, like, rent, if they're not there, they do it the week that they're back.
Yeah, exactly.
So, to my mind, that would just delay the vote. Which is a shame, because like
a lot of people...
Can
we just email the thing to her and
if we email it to her, yeah. She doesn't vote.
We have less 20 minutes.
Okay, let's...
Where did they respond?
Should we call them like right now?
Yeah. Where did they respond?
Calls.
If they don't respond, we gotta decide what to do.
If we don't respond,
okay, if they don't respond, then they just don't vote this week.
They don't vote, yeah. That's me. That's 1-2 ways more person to agree that they can't vote.
If they don't respond.
If they don't respond.
If they don't respond, they just don't vote.
All right, great.
We vote without
them
if they don't respond.
Yeah. I think that's the way to go.
Pearson?
In the Constitution?
No. Do you want to vote?
Yeah.
Your Constitution.
Hey, Pearson is voting. Pearson is voting. Pearson, check your email. You got an email from Henry, not Donovan.
Donovan is winning the race. Do not let him win. Do not let him win.
Not vote for Donovan.
Don't vote.
It's gonna be so canceled.
Okay, wait, hold up.
This is not. It's totally.
What does the end of the year look like?
Yeah, so the end of the year, I mean, on the very last day, there's a few things that kind of happen. There's certain things that are worth money at the end of the year. So like if a kid buys a house, that house is basically redeemable for money at the very end of the game, which is not realistic, but it's my way of trying to simulate how real estate tends to go up in value in the real world. And the way I do it is... I don't grade them on how they play the game, but I do offer extra credit for how they play the game. And I've thought of doing it the other way. I've thought of like, you know, making the whole class just basically how they play this game, but I keep it with extra credit. If a kid does really, really well in the game, they might be able to bump up their grade by like 5-7%, maybe even a little higher if they really just like nailed it. A kid that does so-so in the game might be able to bump their grade up by like 2-3%. And a kid that... I've seen kids end the game with zero money. That's pretty rare. I did have one kid last year who ended with basically zero money and he gets zero extra credit. So I try to balance it so there is incentive there. You know, it's not just like teeny tiny extra credit. You know, if a kid really nails it in the game, they can bump up their grade for sure. But I suspect that the real motivation for playing is not the extra credit. I think it's just, dare I say, a love for the game that, you know, really motivates the kids to play.
And so is the goal to be the person with the most money by the end of the year?
Well, that's a good question too. I never really say anywhere that there's a winner. This is how you win the game, right? There's nowhere in the rules that say this will be the winner. So it's kind of up to kids to define their own way of winning. And I think in terms of designing a game like this, this is important because what I don't want to have happen is I don't want the top five kids to just really care about it and all the kids in the middle and the bottom just stop caring because they know they're not going to win. So I kind of compare it to the Tour de France. So in the Tour de France, there's multiple ways you can kind of win, right? So the yellow jersey is probably the best known, which is really just the person who had the best overall time in this 3-week bike race. But there's also these other awards you can win in the Tour. So there's the green jersey for the best sprinter. And that's really coveted, right? Like that's a big award. Nobody's going for the green and the yellow. It's like you're either going for the yellow or you're going for the green. Then there's the polka dot jersey for the best hill climber. But then every day of the Tour de France, there's a different winner. And that's also really prestigious. So in YOLO, of course, kids are going to pay attention to who has the highest net worth at the end of the game, right? Especially between all my classes. People's eyes are going to be on that. And that's kind of like the yellow jersey. There's also something for sale in the game, which is there's cars in the game. And there's one car per year for all of my classes, which is the Ferrari. And if you buy the Ferrari, I will give you a little blue ribbon. It's the only physical thing you can get in YOLO. And the blue ribbon on it says conspicuous consumption, which is basically the economic term for like bling bling, right? So there's always, and it's $3 million. So nobody can afford this until like at least February or March. You know, 3 years ago, nobody could even afford it the whole year. So that's also something that kids are kind of racing for, you know, like who gets the blue ribbon, but it's totally separate than who has the highest net worth at the end of the game. So those are probably the two most coveted prizes within the game. But then, you know, I think some kids just being the mayor or, you know, the classes can kind of name their own positions, you know, like if they're the mayor or the prime minister for a long time, that's pretty cool to them. You know, if they're the judge, each class has a judge because I do want somebody to kind of help me make legal decisions. You know, I've had kids who've just been the judge the whole year. And to them, that's like a really big deal, you know? So I think that there's a lot of different ways you can, I don't know, I guess I'd say gain prestige within the game or accomplish things within the game.
A lot of the yellow, actual in-game yellow stuff is just extra credit. How do you pull in your what you're actually assessing in the classroom? How do you pull YOLO into that?
Yeah, well, I can tell you about like the curriculum. So in my early years, I used to kind of do YOLO and then the rest of the class, you know, and I kind of went through it in a set order. But with government and economics, you can almost do things in whatever order you want. You know, it's not like algebra where it's like, well, we've got to get to this before we get to that. And we've got to get to that before we get to this other thing. So what I do now is I really structure my whole curriculum around what's happening in the game. So for example, earlier this year, one of the classes, when they're writing their constitution, they were going to put a cap on food prices. Like food's not allowed to be sold for more than X amount. So I've got a homework assignment about food caps, you know, and it talks about a food cap on ice during a hurricane. And then we can also talk about, you know, last year when, what was it in Houston, Hurricane Harvey, when that hurricane hit, there was a cap on gas prices around Texas. We can talk about that. So what happens with food prices? And we spent like 2 days talking about price caps. That kind of leads us into even talking about things like communism, you know, and that's just, you know, from like one thing that happened in the game. So whatever is going on in the game is what I talk about in class. And sometimes I'll kind of talk about different things at different times of the year with different classes. And then sometimes I'll bring it back together. And then when I write tests, I've kind of just got questions associated with topics. So whatever kind of topics we covered in, you know, the last month, okay, I'm going to pull questions pertaining to those topics. And that's what the test is.
So you're changing it every year.
Yep.
It was pretty cool just to sit and listen to some of the teaching opportunities that Mike took advantage of just in the day that I was there.
I made $40,000 from her, and that's it.
So, but here's the thing. So, okay, you made $40,000 from her. So you can figure out the percentage on this investment, right? So $64,000 over 20 weeks. Well, no, and do you have a contract with her for the rest of the year?
No, it's endless. It's just she only paid me $40,000.
So that $64,000 is basically, and it's shanty, right?
Yeah.
So it's gonna be
She has a shanty. Oh. But she's just living on my land.
Yeah.
That's all.
So, oh yeah, because you paid $50,000 for the land, and then you only got $40,000 for the land, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was not a good deal.
Yeah. Really bad deal.
We've had the free market this whole year, and it hasn't solved this problem.
Because no one wants to be a farmer. If people want.
The free market works if you have thousands and thousands of people, but in 19 people, it does not work well. This is why we need
communism.
No.
Not implementing socialism. That. It's not gonna.
Communism might work, but probably not. Anyways, people want to have free will.
I'm going to communism.
I don't understand. Why are people voting for
Donald Trump? Because people prefer us.
Why, though?
Now, here's the question, though, is could your government have solved this problem better than the free market? And if so, how?
Yes. Wow. I mean, we've already got stuff working on it. We've got the government covering food and health insurance to help people who don't have money try to solve this. Now all we need is more farmers and more doctors to help combat this problem.
Well, you need more farmers. Farmers have a lot more value than doctors in terms of food. And do you think that your early threats of taxation on the farmers is part of what led to there being less farmers?
No.
Do you think your current taxes are part of what's discouraging farming?
No.
How would it not be discouraging if you have to pay so much in taxes?
It's
not exactly the free market at work, though, right? Like, there's...
Yes,
there's
I mean, before
the threat of higher taxes.
What you've got to do is you've got to look at before it happened. What happened was they were just raising prices, and Mia had insane prices. Now, if she was feeling taxation, she would have lowered the prices so that that didn't happen. Raising prices would only have encouraged more taxation. She obviously did not fear that taxes would come.
Fair enough, but I'm looking at earlier in the year when she was charging super low prices because she was afraid that you guys were going to put a cap on how much she could sell for. And if she had charged higher prices at the beginning, she would have had more money to invest right now. And first of all, she's only farming 3 plots instead of 4. Like, you know, if she had more money, she could have been farming a 4th plot a lot earlier. She also just bought tractors like a week or two ago. If she charged higher prices early on, she could add tractors earlier, which frees up more labor for the rest of the class, which is kind of what you guys need, more people doing other stuff. So I don't know if you can say this is all the result of the free market, because I don't think you've really been on a free market.
Early on, the free market was...
And so Mike continues to dialogue with the student Sam on whether they truly had a free market society or not, to which Sam later began to point out some of the problems of only having one car manufacturer and the monopoly that student had made, to which that student, Ethan, did not really take too kindly to.
Yes, but the reason she doesn't have tractors is because of Ethan being the only auto manufacturer because
of
that.
I built two for free already. I built two Tritons more for free.
But
he wants me to build more for free.
No, not for free.
I mean, what I'm saying is, you ruined the government, and now you're trying to take even more of my resources. You ruined our class, you ruined the government, and now you're trying to take more of my money and more of my stuff.
Let's just see what the people think.
You are a commie. You're a communist. You're anti-American.
No,
Anti-USA. USA. 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 Okay,
this is the tactics they are resorting to.
It's me, Ananya, and Henry Kaufman.
They just announced the winners of the election.
Let's see. Did the people support your ideas or support our ideas?
It's actually 50-50.
Half the people didn't even know what they voted for. Half the people didn't even know.
Let's be civil. Everyone.
Let's have a talk with members of parliament.
Why
are you not going to put down my center?
Let's go full Ukrainian government in here.
What was it that pushed you to kind of want to make a game of your government and economics class?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you where I got the idea. So I saw a TED talk in probably 2010, and this was before I'd even gone into teaching, and it was about a game called the World Peace Game. And this guy does it with elementary school kids, and he'd been doing it for like 20 years, and it looked awesome.
So this World Peace Game I'd like to tell you about. It started out like this. It's just a 4-foot by 5-foot plywood board in an inner city urban school, 1978. I was creating a lesson for students on Africa. We put all the problems of the world there, and I thought, let's let them solve it. I didn't want to lecture or have just book reading. I wanted to have them be immersed and learn the feeling of learning through their bodies. And so we made the game, and it has since evolved to a 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot plexiglass structure, and it has 4 plexiglass layers. There's an outer space layer with black holes and satellites and research satellites and asteroid mining. There's an air and space level with clouds, big puffs of cotton we push around, and territorial airspaces and air forces. A ground and sea level with thousands of game pieces on it, even an undersea level with submarines and undersea mining. There are 4 countries around the board. The kids make up the names of their countries. Some are rich, some are poor. They have different assets, commercial and military. Each country has a cabinet. There's a prime minister, secretary of state, minister of defense, and a CFO or comptroller. I choose a prime minister based on my relationship with them. I offer them the job, they can turn it down. And then they choose their own cabinet. There's a World Bank, arms dealers, and a United Nations. There's also a weather goddess who controls a random stock market and random weather. That's not all. And then there's a 13-page crisis document with 50 interlocking problems. So that if one thing changes, everything else changes. I throw them into this complex matrix, and they trust me because we have a deep, rich relationship together. And so with all these crises, we have, ethnic and minority tensions. We have chemical and nuclear spills, nuclear proliferation. There's oil spills, environmental disasters, water rights disputes, breakaway republics, famine, endangered species, and global warming. If Al Gore is here, I'm going to send my 4th graders from Agnew Hurd and Venable School to you because they solved global warming in a week.
And I always grew up playing games, games like Monopoly, Risk, and later Settlers of Catan. And these are games that are strategy, right? These are games that are social. These are games that require you to think critically and deal with unique situations. They're games that require you to negotiate. And I loved these games. I played really competitively with my family and my friends, and I feel like I learned a lot from these games. And when I saw this TED talk about the World Peace Game, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like a game like I love being played in a classroom. What an amazing way to teach. Well, then I become a teacher. And I try to look up, how do I play the World Peace Game? And at the time, he didn't even have instructions or anything like that. Nowadays, you can actually go take a class with him that teaches you how to do the World Peace Game. But at the time, that wasn't available. So I was like, I'm just going to make up my own game. And the first year was tiny. It was really, really just small. It was like a tenth of what it is now. And kids liked it. So the second year, I made it a lot bigger. That was where it was a little bit more recognizable to what it is now. And kids kept loving it. And the admin was pretty happy with it too, you know? So every year kids loved it. The admin loved it. And I just kept on kind of making it bigger and bigger. I've changed the rules every year. I've already got ideas for what I'm going to change next year, but every year it kind of changes a little less and solidifies a little bit more. And I think it just gets a little bit better and better every year. And this is the 7th year I've played it. And it's kind of really become its own thing.
If someone wanted to introduce gamification into their classroom, how would they even get started?
You know, my advice would be try to create one day games. You know, like my very first year, I started doing a lot of one day games. A lot of those kind of turned into different dynamics in YOLO. Set up a competitive environment. A lot of people hear games and there's just different kinds of games, right? This is not role playing. This is not Pictionary. Those are all fun genres of game, but this is strategy. This is competitive. So I want it to be a competitive environment. Some kids shy away from competition. Some kids love it. But I think what I'm doing is something different than what they get in most of their other classes. In most of their other classes, they're being prepared for certain careers, really. You know, I think school is really good at preparing kids for certain types of careers. If you're going to be a doctor, you've got to be good at school. You're going to go to school till you're like in your 30s, right? And you've got to learn so much stuff. If you're going to be a lawyer, you've got to be able to read like crazy, right? But if you're going to be an entrepreneur, is school really preparing you for that, right? Like, what do entrepreneurs do? Well, they solve complex problems, right? So when I set up a game, I'm setting up a competitive environment that is putting kids in a position to solve a complex problem. You know, it's not a problem where they can just sit down and solve it. It's a problem that is open-ended. And I believe that's probably a lot like what being an entrepreneur is like. You know, like you don't know how many customers you're going to get. You don't know what's going to happen if you raise your price. The only way to find out is to take an educated guess and try and then learn from your mistakes. And that's the environment I'm trying to simulate with YOLO or any game I set up in a classroom.
So I actually, there's three different sizes of houses that each cost me more to make the larger they get. And I request a larger amount of money as a commission each time I build a larger house. So for shanties, it's $50,000 for me to build and I only take $15,000 in commission. For suburban Splendor is what it's called. It cost me $150,000 to make, and I charge $200,000. So I'm making $50,000 on that. I could be charging people a lot more. People are willing to pay more, but I'm trying to keep my customer base, because at a later date, people are probably going to want to tear down their house and build a larger house. So if I've proved myself as being like reliable and upfront and transparent, then they'll probably come back to me to build their home instead of. I'm currently the only contractor in this period, but at a later date in our constitution, we just ratified that there's like bidding for really large projects that get you a lot of money, government sponsored. So that'll incentivize becoming a contractor at a later date. So to have a customer base already built up is a good thing to.
So you're playing the long game.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I heard that there's like. But to that, what do you do with kids that? You know, competitions just really, they don't enjoy that aspect of the game.
Yeah. I actually had a kid just last week who I could tell was not super enthused about it. You know, a lot of YOLO days, they kind of did the bare minimum. I don't let kids work on anything other than YOLO. So if they finish YOLO early, they can't work on their other homework. You know, and some of them think it's ridiculous, you know, like, well, I'm done. Why can't I work on this? Well, because I want to force you to play YOLO, right? But with this particular kid, I actually sat down with them in a YOLO day. And this is one of the good things about YOLO too, is it runs itself so much that I can kind of move around the classroom and talk to kids in really small groups. And so I went and really sat and talked to the student for probably 20, 25 minutes about like where they're at. You know, like, why aren't you enjoying YOLO? And what they said actually surprised me in this instance. They're like, it's too crazy. Like, the classroom is just too crazy. So I kind of said, you know, it is. And a lot of jobs are actually kind of crazy. You know, like, some jobs are not quiet. You know, like, I've got a friend who's an ER doctor. Like, his job is nuts, right? You know, once I said that, they kind of heard that. I think what I did was I kind of pointed them in the right direction. I think part of the reason they were disengaged was because they didn't really know what to do. You know, and this student in particular was a student who actually gets pretty good grades. I believe they have straight A's. And I think they'd never been in a situation like this. And to me, that actually is an opportunity for tremendous growth. So I pointed them in the right direction. And what I encouraged them to do was to, this particular student's job is a doctor. And doctors in the game can basically raise other people's health ratings. And what I encouraged them to do is get out and try to find the best price. Don't just lock down one person and sell it to them for the whole year. Like, get out and try to negotiate. And I asked if they'd ever negotiated for anything in their life. And they said, no, but my mom did once in Europe, you know, when they're buying a painting or whatever. And I said, you know, this is an opportunity for you to try negotiating for something. And if you go out and negotiate and fail, no big deal. It's just YOLO. You know, like, but if you learn something from that negotiation and then you go out in the real world someday and you don't make a mistake because of YOLO, oh my gosh, is that worth it or what? And I think they really heard my message. And the next day they were actually really into it.
I'd rather learn the hard way in a simulation in the beginning of the year than, you know, in real life. You know,
heck yeah, absolutely. I used to have a boss and he would, whenever like something happened where he like made a bad decision or lost a bunch of money, he'd just go, education is expensive.
And that's one of my biggest fears with the game is, you know, there's always going to be kids that, I mean, there's kids that are obsessed with it. Like, I think there's certain kids that spend more time reading the YOLO rulebook than they've ever spent studying anything in their life, right? But there's certain kids who always are just less enthused than others. And I think my approach is to encourage them to participate, because if you don't, it's just going to be a pretty boring year. Kind of on that note too, one thing that I've found really interesting with the game is that there is almost no correlation with who does good in YOLO and what their grades are. Sometimes the kids who thrive at YOLO are kids that are barely passing classes. Sometimes the straight A students, I think, struggle with YOLO more than any class they've ever struggled with. And sometimes the straight A students do great. You know, there's really no correlation. But I think that's pretty cool, because I've definitely had kids who I think their success in YOLO has been the thing they've been most successful at in their life, or certainly their academic career. Again, there's something maybe realistic about that, because there might be a job field that they are very well suited for and that school is not preparing them for. Games have a way of finding kids where they're at and teaching them the appropriate lesson. I've had probably three times over the years where I've seen a kid counting a stack of money and they've asked something really basic, like, wait, I know this sounds stupid, but 1,000 comes after 999, right? You know, these are like sophomores and juniors at a pretty darn good high school. It's amazing to me that they've kind of made it this far, not knowing something so fundamental. But what YOLO is doing is it's finding where they're at and challenging them. You know, for those kids, just counting a stack of money is really something new and foreign and that they've never done. But then on the more, you know, for the higher flyers, I've got kids like, you know, like maybe three kids a year figure out what an amortization schedule is, because I use amortization schedules for home loans. I'm pretty sure most adults don't understand amortization schedules. When I bought a house and I'm talking to the loan officer, I asked him a question about the amortization schedule that I felt stupid for not knowing. And he didn't know the answer. And he asked the other three guys in his office and none of them knew the answer. I'm like, I think actually nobody understands this stuff. And, you know, I do it in my game and most kids take out a home loan and don't understand it. But two or three kids a year do. They figure it out. And, you know, I had one kid driving around Austin with an amortization calculator looking at home prices, like, and figuring out what the monthly payment would be on a 25-year versus a 30-year loan. And it's like, that's a kid learning a complex lesson through the game. And the game just somehow magically found where he was at and what he needed to learn. So I think this is, you know, an advantage of gamification that I didn't even really see for years, is that it just somehow magically finds where kids are at and teaches them the appropriate lesson and presents them with the appropriate challenge.
As you were sharing, I was thinking, because I know dozens of people have told you, Mike, you need to put something together.
Yeah.
And you need to make it available for people if they want to try this. But if you were to share the rule book with people,
yeah,
is that even something that would be enough of a starting point for someone to try this in their room, or do you feel it's the complexity of it is too great without some guidance?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is I'm not sure. I've definitely started trying to design the rule book with this in mind, right? That like I would like to see some other teachers try it out. I think if I just gave somebody the rule book, they might be like completely overwhelmed by it. So I don't know. I mean, the way the World Peace Guy does it, I've thought about that, you know, where like if you're going to teach this game, you come in and like, what I'd love to do is you spend like 5 days with me or a long weekend with me playing the game with other teachers, you know, and then we kind of dissect the game like that. And then you could go off and teach this game. But I would be curious to see somebody else try it in a classroom.
I'll be sure to share your email at the end of the show.
Please do. And
in
the description. And anybody, and then, really reach out to me if you're interested in gamification or maybe even giving it a whirl in your classroom or something like that.
Mike, I appreciate you sharing everything you had. I knew we wouldn't be able to get into all the intricacies of the game with the podcast, but I really appreciate your thoughts on the gamification and ideas of like small scale ways that people could do this, and the challenge and the invitation to other teachers out there that want to try to give this a whirl and at least know they're getting into something complex when they get that Google Doc from you.
Yeah.
How many pages is the rule book?
Oh, it's like 25-30 pages right
now. Okay. Okay. So anyone who's willing to take a look at it, I'll share Mike's email in the description of the podcast. So feel free to reach out to him. So I appreciate you coming on, Mike.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Tom Gibson Podcast. And if you would like to reach out to Mike Franz, you can email him at m.franz, F-R-A-N-Z, at headwaters.org, H-E-A-D-W-A-T-E-R-S.org. I've also left a link in the show notes to the living document that is his YOLO rulebook. So feel free to take a look at it, explore it, and email Mike if you have any questions or want to try something along these lines in your own classroom. If you enjoyed this episode of the Tom Gibson Podcast, please leave a rating or review in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It'll help other people find the show if you think this could bring value to other educators. And if you'd like to stay in the loop with any upcoming episodes of the Tom Gibson Podcast, new episodes are released monthly. Thanks so much for listening, and hopefully I'll see you in the next podcast.